Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, weekly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And today we've got Emmerich Augustin with us, who's a longtime Django contributor, member of the Django technical board and more. Hello, Emmerich. How are you?
Hello, folks. I'm fine.
Fine. Thank you for coming on so much.
It's a pleasure to be on the podcast.
So, right. Okay, well, I'm just going to a few smart mildly for a moment, because you know, when I've got into Django, you're one of the big sort of people there. You're one of the people who were contributing then. You're still around now, and it's just like, wow. So can you tell us about how you got into Django and how did you find the project, and, you know, kind of some of your backstory there?
Well, I think it's mostly a happy accident. So it goes back to 2010, I think. And at this point, I was working in a company whose favorite framework was Rails, which is a good framework, by the way. And then one of my colleagues, one day, he tells me about this framework he found that's called Django, and it's written in Python. And I had used a bit of Python earlier in internships, but I didn't know much about the language. And so this guy, Jérémy Lenné, is really enthusiastic about Django. And so I check it out. And I'm not sure exactly what happens next. Probably I use it for a personal project or something. And then I stumble on a bug, and I discover the bug tracker, and I start triaging bugs. And so people have weird hobbies. Some people do crosswords, and I do triage. And then I do a lot of triage. Eventually, I start knowing a lot about the dark corners of Django where no one ever goes, except when you're finding a bug in the framework or trying to figure out if something is actually a bug. And I start knowing a lot about Django. At one point in 2011, there's a new project where I get to choose a stack. And so I decide, okay, let's do a real thing with Django this time, everything Django. And so we become a fairly heavy users of a framework. So that was for building Autolib, which was a car sharing service in Paris. And so we're invoicing car rentals. And so we're invoicing by the minute, because it's a self-service thing. You take a car, you drop it back. And so we need accurate billing. And then since we're good engineers, we start thinking what happens during the daylight savings time change. Are we going to invoice minutes, minus 20 minutes, if someone takes the car at 2:50 and returns it at 2:10? And that's how I discovered that Django doesn't have support for aware date times. So when you're publishing on the blog, a naive date right. times are just fine. When you're doing a newspaper, which is what Django was built for, it's fine. But when you're doing enterprise stuff, it can be a bit limited. And so that's how I start writing a proposal to support aware date times with time zone information in Django. Eventually this led up to me joining the team. So at the time, the one of the criteria for joining the Django core team was you must have written a major patch. And so I had the patch almost written, and the team let me commit it. So yeah, that's how I become a contributor.
Well, that's fantastic. That's like, wow.
Well, and that was, I think it's 1.4 was when time zones was added in.
I'm not completely sure when we began to do LTS. 1.4 was definitely a big release. Then in 1.5, we started working on Python 3. 1.6 was partly about making Python 3 work correctly. And then the next big one, which was hard to get to, was 1.7, since there was the new migrations framework. And also I broke a lot of stuff with app loading, which I still believe to be a good thing in the grand scheme of Django as a framework. But it was sometimes cause of some upgrade pain.
Yeah. And then you were responsible for templates as well, weren't you?
So that's what I did in 1.8, if memory serves. So the pluggable template engines. This one was probably less significant because there were third-party applications that made it possible to use Jinja 2 in Django, which was, well, the primary requirement there. But having it built in into the framework was good. And also it was an opportunity to clean up some parts of the template engine that still relied a bit too heavily on global state. So now it's a bit more library-like.
Yeah, okay.
Can you talk about... So who were the active Django contributors back then? Because I feel like a lot of that knowledge is locked away in a small number of people's brains. Like, I don't know exactly who that was. I mean, I have a vague sense. Carlton came, you know, before me, but after you. Mm. Do you recall who was there at that time in, 2011, 12?
Okay, I'm definitely going to forget some people, so this is a tricky question. One very active contributor at the time was Yanis Leidel, alias Jezdez. He became a core developer a couple of years before I did. He contributed to countless libraries and also a lot to Django Core. At the time, we didn't have fellows yet. This came later. We already had a team of maybe 20 or 30 commiters, so the project was still driven, by the second team. I mean, there was a very original team, which was Adrian Jacob, who was the creator of the framework. Then shortly after came Malcolm and Russell, who is still around. Another couple of people, I think, but they were less active when I joined, so I didn't meet them as much as I did these original four. The team grew to maybe 20 or 25. And at this time, people were still writing and committing their own code, which is something we stopped doing now. Everything goes through the fellows, etc. So back then, someone had written a patch, uploaded it to Track. You took the patch, you tweaked it a bit, you committed it to SVN, of course. It was a bit different.
That's what I like about the Track. So something comes up every so often, people are like, why don't we move to GitHub Issues? Because GitHub's more user-friendly or more, not user-friendly, but it's more accessible to new contributors. But like the Track has this amazing history. So like all the old subversion commits are mapped and you just click on them and they map back and end up opening up in GitHub with like, this was the patch that was done 13 years ago by, so-and-so. I like that whole, the history is still maintained.
Yes, we've kept a lot of history in Track. It must go nearly 14 years now, I think.
Something like that.
When talking about Track versus GitHub Issues, I always feel a bit old school. I'm a Django Core dinosaur. I'm stay aware of that.
Get off my lawn.
And because things were that way once doesn't mean it's the only way to do it. One thing we always said we were very attached to is anyone being able to triage bug. For a very long time in GitHub, only contributors who had commit access could tag issues, could close issues. Perhaps this is a bit theoretical because, in fact, most of the triage is done by just a few people, and now most of it is done by fellows, so including yourself, Carlton, and Marius. I'm not sure these arguments hold all that well. And also, GitHub introduced this feature to allow anonymous triage, or at least to make it much more open, a few months ago. And I haven't checked it out. So now the other things to consider if we wanted to move to GitHub Issues is first, how do we preserve the history? I've come across a lot of projects who imported their bug tracker to GitHub Issues, and often some information is kept, but a lot is lost. Many links are broken. And I think the history in Track is valuable. Very often I find valuable information that dates back to 5 or 10 years because we are very conscious about writing why we do things in ticket discussions. And the other is more an open source purist thing. GitHub is a closed source run by a corporation. Probably there's a way to export the data, but it looks like, okay, use the API and scrape with the API. And somewhat we're comfortable with our self-hosted track where we have the database and we know where the data is.
I think the big one there for me is the history, because on a day-to-day basis, we get three new tickets a day on average. And it'll be like, there's some issue with model form and, this has got to have come up before. And you're able to search and you're able to think, you're able to say, look, this was discussed 6 years ago in this comment and here's why that and that's just amazing. And, so the other project I've worked on a lot is Django REST framework, and that's always used GitHub. And you're in the position where you're like, oh, I'm sure this has come up before, but I just can't find it. It's there if you happen to find it, but to track it down is a much more laborious issue. So, whilst GitHub is, it's exciting or whatever, I don't think it's as powerful. But the Python project are migrating now, right? They're migrating all their bug tracker to GitHub, so we get to see what happens to them and how they manage it, and then we can make a decision based on that example.
Yeah, and it's good that you have a comparison point with DRF, which is already a mature project. It's been going for at least 8 years, I guess, or maybe 10. And somewhat it reinforces that we can live with track, even if it's, perhaps a bit newcomer unfriendly. And then the other argument, the GitHub closed source, etc. Yes, it's a purist thing, but some people feel very, very strongly about that. And that's always a factor when you need consensus to change that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, I did want to mention, I don't know if we have in the podcast, just around new contributors, that Carlton has been doing a lot of work to apply to Google Summer of Docs, which Django has been accepted for. And so we're hoping we'll be getting money to have someone, to a professional technical writer, to work on just specifically the contribution section of the Django docs, which I think could use some fresh eyes. So I'm excited about that. And I know Carlton's been doing a lot of work on that. So I wanted to call that out, Carlton, because I don't know if others
I'm excited about
that you're driving
one thing,
that.
I've been sort of beating the more contributors drum for last couple of years. And the feedback that I've had several times is it's just really hard to get going. And it's a kind of wall of text the contributors got. It's brilliant. There's everything you need to know, but maybe it could be smoother. We're not technical writers not as a group. That's not where we focus. So if we can have someone come in and give that a fresh look, that's quite exciting for me. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and it's nice to have outside money to help us do that, I guess, is part of it too.
Yeah, it's really cool that we're getting people dedicated to this. We're doing okay at writing code. I think we've done much better than many other projects at writing documentation.
Yeah, no.
And so if you print to PDF the Django documentation, I think it runs 1,500 pages or so.
Yeah.
And so there's really a lot of information. I think we raised the bar very impressively. Now it's still expert documentation written by experts. I have written some pages in that documentation from scratch, and then I read them 3 years later, and I decided I should really write them differently. But I don't know exactly how to go about it, because while I understand what's important when writing documentation, I can see good documentation when I see it. I recognize it, but I can't write it myself. And I'm probably not the only one.
Yeah, I think that's a fair.
Well, we had Mikey Ariel on, who is a professional technical writer. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing I've realized, being much more junior programmer than you all, is that there's a big difference between documentation and tutorials. So one of the complaints perhaps of someone new to Django is they'll go into the docs and see a documentation that airdrops in and says, okay, well, we have we have this existing site, and then we're just going to add this little thing. So they show the view portion, they show the model portion, which if you know Django well, you can use that. But if you're a beginner, intermediate, you need all the rest to get you to that point. You can't just airdrop in. Mm-hmm. So initially I was frustrated with the Django docs that they didn't do that. But I understand now that a tutorial and documentation are very different things. So a lot of what I do is tutorials to kind of ramp someone up. So when they get to the docs, they can see, oh, this is relevant, but they have the context for it, because docs is intentionally written for an intermediate advanced level, I would say. And that makes a lot more sense to me than, you know, I mean, if it was tutorials, it would be 100,000 pages, the documentation.
Well, to be fair, there was foresight in the way the Django documentation was written. In fact, a great number of things were done right very, very early when Django was open sourced. I think I heard Jacob explain once how he bought books and read them about essentially how to do an open source project right. And one of the things that was done in the documentation was to separate tutorials from how-to guides from reference documentation. And then there's the contributing documentation. And then it grew from there. But the distinction, the original distinction between tutorial, here's how you get started, how to, you want to do a specific thing, so here's a whole bunch of explanations on a given topic, and reference is everything you need to know on this part of the frameworks, the APIs, etc. It was there. And if you look at the index page, it's right there under your eyes. Now, if you come to the docs through Google, you don't know if you're landing in a how-to or in a reference page, and you don't know that there's a tutorial. So the doc is good if you get to the home page and start reading it. Perhaps it's a bit different if you get airdropped by Google somewhere and you don't understand the whole logic, especially when there are 1,500 pages.
Yeah. Yeah, no, fair enough. I mean, I still think Django docs are the gold standard. I guess part of it is I'm thinking of this for my own work as a content creator, where if I want to do something, if I want to demonstrate sitemaps, for example, I just have a recent tutorial on it. I want to show the sitemap part, but I also need to have all the preamble. And so what I've, just with my own stuff, what I'm going to be doing is having a canonical, like a recipes app, where I say, okay, here's this one place, I will walk you through all the steps. And then all these other things like the search or this fancy thing or this specific thing, I'm going to jump from this starting point. So if you need the help, here you go, but I'm not going to just start from start project every time, which is what I've been doing with my stuff, which I think is helpful for people, but is unmaintainable for me to start from absolute scratch every time. And I know that Django, you know, there's the Poles app, there's university examples. When I kind of airdrop in through Google, I suppose it would be nice if there were a couple canonical reference points, but there's so much information in the docs, it's probably more than could be done from scratch. But anyways, that's the context I think of that. I think it's nice to be able to say, if you need the help, it's here, but I'm not going to, I can focus on the point that I want to focus on.
Well, the docs is still a living project. Regularly, someone goes in and improve a section.
Yeah.
And it's really like gardening. I mean, things have grown. People have grown some pages, some content. And then at some point, someone needs to rationalize it. And it helps. And sometimes also, we are facing the limits than what... Django core devs. So now we no longer have core devs. We removed this. But for a long time, these were the people who created all this. And perhaps they were not the best people at writing a tutorial. And now everyone admits that the Django Girls tutorial is a better one. And so we freely point people to that tutorial. And the official tutorial is still there because we need one. But well, that's a kind of local optimum. And no one has taken the task of explaining what a better tutorial for Django could be besides the Django World tutorial that already exists, so there's no need to do anything about it.
I mean, it's a massive job to write such a thing as well. I mean, that's not everything has to be in the Django docs too. I like that there's room for like content creators to come and add things around the core documentation. But the other day I had someone tweet at me on Twitter, thanks for the docs, they're amazing. It's like, well, you're welcome. I didn't write them, but you're welcome.
And perhaps going back to tutorials for just a comment, I think tutorials are one of the hardest things to write because you need to decide that you are not going to talk about a bunch of things that are very important, but not fundamental. And so you're going to stick to the fundamentals and take some shortcuts, hide a few things just for the sake of getting to the end of the tutorial in a decent amount of time. And this is really hard and prone to bike shedding. So a bit difficult to do in an open source community.
Yeah. I'm smiling when you say that, because that is the show versus tell tension is one that, as a content creator, I have all the time. It's probably the top feedback I've gotten with my beginner stuff, is that I just sort of show the steps without explaining everything that happens. But it's because if I explained everything that happened, it wouldn't be for beginners. And so there is a balance there between getting it to work and then understanding everything. And I like to say, you know, hey, everything is magic at some point. And so it's just a question of adding in, okay, this is how this works, this is how that works. I can use it without understanding all of it. Because ultimately, why do people use Django? They want to build the site. So if I can show them, you know, build a blog, and then we can loop in and talk about some of the internals, which I think become interesting once you have spent time with them. But, you know, an outsider, I think, doesn't particularly care about the internals. They just want an outcome. It only comes with time that they find the internals interesting.
And that's yet another bias of the people who wrote the code. It's like they would like to show off all the smart things that they did in the code.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's definitely exactly. not what needs to be in a tutorial. Another thing that I find very hard is that when you write documentation, you need to stick roughly at the right distance from what people already know. If you are too basic, well, the documentation is slow and people get bored. And if you are too far, it's simply not understandable. Perhaps if you're doing a lot of writing for beginners or intermediate people, you get a better feel about this distance. But I find it really hard, in fact, to judge.
You have to make an assumption, I think, is what it comes down to. You have to make an assumption about their level and then go from there. So a blog for a beginner is different, for an intermediate is different, for advanced. And the hard part is deciding and then sticking to it. Especially, you know, for me, as my own knowledge has advanced, I find it's not interesting for me to show another very beginner thing. But because I interact every day with beginners, it kind of keeps me in that mindset where it's interesting and not just monotonous for me. So I certainly feel I don't really want to code beginner stuff, because I kind of know that. But at the same time, I get the perspective of beginners and their frustrations, and I recall my own frustrations. So it's a hard thing. And that's why I say with the docs, you have to me, I think the docs are at an intermediate level, as they should be. And it's sort of one of the things actually I want to do in my own online site is mimic what you would do in person, where in person, the first thing you would do is kind of say, well, what's your level? Because then I will talk to you at that level. So one thing I think I will be doing is having okay, are you a beginner? Are you intermediate? Are you advanced? Like, tell me, and then I will point you to tutorials that go up from that jumping off place. Because without that, it's hard to know where someone's at. And it's hard to write those things. I think it's harder to write the beginner things, actually, than the advanced things, because you can't assume anything. I think it's harder, actually, to write the beginner ones.
Let's say...
Because if you have the knowledge of...
It's very easy to skip an implicit piece of information, and without that information, the gap, the story doesn't make sense.
The example that comes to mind there is imports. So quite a lot of times in the documentation, we'll get a pull request saying, can we please add the import for, you know, this particular class that we're showing using? Because people come to the docs and it's like, well, where do I get this? Where is this class? And it's just not shown. And then as soon as you add the import to the code example, it's become so much more useful.
There are a couple of tricks for interacting with the Django docs. And I know them and I feel bad about them. So one is that it's usually better to type site:docs.djangoproject.com your query in Google than use the built-in search engine. Because Google is just better at search engines. And the other one is when you hover the name of a function in API documentation, you get a link, and in that link there is an anchor, and the anchor contains the full import path. And so this is how you know the import path when it isn't written. That's completely implicit.
Yeah.
And people have explained in Traktor that we're doing this usually when they asked making the import implicit, explicit, I mean. But yeah, it's bad that we're relying on this.
Yeah. I mean, there's probably some Sphinx plugin that we could find that would fix all of that for us, but we're yet to find it. One thing I wanted to talk to you about, Emmerich, was while I've got you on, is the Django static files story. Because these, you know, back in the day, very much static rendered HTML, and you know, I'm a big fan of that still, and I like to render templates and serve up HTML, but a lot of times we serve up API data, and then we as a single page application, and we merge it with React or, you know, Vue or some whatever rich client. And something that comes up every year, I think, is what's Django's static file story, or can we improve it? And I know you've got thoughts on this, so I did want to sort of, while we had you, ask you to comment on that if you can.
Yes, I think static files is a vastly underappreciated part of Django. And Yanis has been doing an amazing job there to bring it to a level where it's very generally useful without becoming a full asset pipeline that would have no place in Django. I mean, at some point, if you want Webpack, use Webpack. Yeah. So if we rewind the story, originally, you deploy Django on Apache with Mod Python or Mod Whiskey later, and Apache is going to store your files, CSS, JavaScript, user uploaded media. At first it was a newspaper, so it was editors uploaded images that would get served together with a website. And so Apache says all this. So one of the first distinctions that crops up is that user-provided media is not the same as JavaScript and CSS. And so this is when Django starts separating static files from media files. This is not completely clean yet. When you define a form, there's still a form, a media API, which is actually static files. And we could clean this up. It's not a very big deal, but it's unclean. So then, as the world progresses from just stacking bunch of jQuery plugins and CSS files, as things less like SAS appear, best practices for managing scripts and styles appear, essentially practices about cache invalidation. The most reliable way to invalidate a resource on the web is not to mess with HTTP headers, because there's always a browser that will get it wrong. It's just to change the name of the file and cache everything forever. So modern static files does this well. It takes a bunch of CSS and JavaScript, spread out your Django application, hashes the content of the file, add the hash in the file name, and then you can serve everything cached forever. And then if you use white noise, you can do everything inside your WYSIWYG application with good performance, and you no longer need to care about serving static files separately from the website itself. So this is really good. And it's also compatible with modern JavaScript practices. Because if you, let's say you've built a front end with something like React or Vue or whatever, Ember, you bundle it with a bundler such as Webpack, this produces a bunch of JavaScript files. You can tell Django to use the directory where these files end up. You put it in static files dirs. And then this is how you can bridge between Django and a front-end framework when you're still building something that looks like a traditional website where everything is served from the same URL. And so if you want to optimize this, you can do a few things like avoiding double hashing. If Webpack hashes once and Django hashes a second time, you can also live with it, because honestly, it's not a big deal. But very often, people get confused about how do I do modern JavaScript front-end with Django, and the answer is just do your front-end, and then gives the file to Django and lets static files handle the rest. And it can result in a fairly simple deployment pipeline. So now, if you want to know all the gory details, there's a few posts on my blog where I explain how to do this. And I call it the hybrid app model because it's hybrid between a traditional Django plus templates, server-side stuff, and a modern browser-side application.
Super.
Yeah, we're definitely going to link to those. I think it's three posts that you wrote. I found those to be excellent. I mean, obviously excellent, but illuminative for me when I was going through this, I think 2 years ago, and because it is a common thing that comes up. And I recall seeing Jacob Kaplan-Moss give a talk on static files at PyCon 2019, where he sort of spent a lot of time to think, is there a much easier story than what we have? I guess just, you know, for coupling static files, and his answer was not so much. Keep it simple.
Well, there's another fairly simple story, which is the single page application architecture. When you deploy on one side a static HTML index that is just there for booting some JavaScript that builds the entire application. On the other side, you deploy an API, and the only thing you need to get right is cross-origin requests. Because the API will run on a different domain from where the HTML is served, and usually authentication. So this is also something when I was doing consulting, I've repeatedly seen people tying themselves into knots with this, bringing up JWT into the mix, which is honestly not necessary for this purpose. Just authenticate with cookies on the domain of the API, it will work just fine, and set up your cross-origin request headers properly. And in one of these blog posts you just mentioned, there's the whole story. But again, if you think you need JWT to do this, you're probably opening yourself to security risks, and you shouldn't.
Hmm. We just had David Sanders on, who wrote the Django Simple JWT package, which is now, I think, the default JWT package. And just for those who want further discussion of JWTs, I wanted to ask you about Django Sesame, which is one of your projects that I find really interesting. So this is Magic Links, where URL one-click login. Can you talk about why you wrote this and how it might be used? Because I'm probably going to be using it for something very soon. So when I found this, I forget who showed it to me. I was like, oh my God.
It was me.
Oh, it was Carlton. Well, of course it was Carlton. Of course it was Carlton. It was Carlton.
A really cool backstory about this one, and also some hot news. Like any self-respecting geek, I'm not going to give my photos to a proprietary ecosystem because I care about my photos and I still want to have them around in 50 years. So I'm storing them in JPEG in a file system that I can sync anywhere. So they used to be synced on my laptop, on a server I owned, and on S3. And now I have decided that S3 is fairly reliable, and so they're just on my laptop and on S3. So anyway, I still like watching my photos on the web, and S3 is not a very convenient way to do that. And so I built a small application that's called Django Gallery, or Mix Gallery, because it's just my own, to have an index of the photos of the database and a few views to show them by albums. So very basic stuff. And nowhere near as good anything you'd get on any cloud-based service. But it works with my directory of photos on S3. And then I got children, and I wanted to show the photos to my family. And so they needed a way to access the photos. But I didn't want to put them on the whole internet, obviously. And so I need to give access to my personal website. And at some point, giving to your parents a login and a password to watch the photos on your personal website starts feeling a bit weird. And so I decided I was just going to send something that they can click and be authenticated with django.contrib.auth and get access to the photos. And then there's a super elaborate permission system in Mix Gallery that's so complicated that I never implemented fully. But that's yet another story. So Django Sesame, which used to be called Django URL Auth, but there was another Django URL Auth, so I had to change the name, was created to do this. It's a niche use case, But there are many, many other and much more common use cases for using tokens. And so then I generalized the system to support tokens that could expire, which didn't matter in the original use case, to support one-time tokens, that sort of thing. And the project has a little bit of success. And now,
I love that backstory.
For the hot news, recently a contributor suggested a better design for the tokens. So it's a fairly theoretical argument. Since I want tokens to be invalidated on password change, this is a decent way to invalidate tokens. I'm hashing the hash of the password in the token. So it's supposed to be secure, but when you take the hashed password in the Django database and put it into something that will be in URLs, in emails, in web server logs, virtually everywhere, it feels a bit shaky, even if you think you're cryptographically secure. And so this guy said, why don't you take just the hash part and not the salt and the algorithm and everything else? Then it's more secure because you have entropy from the salt in addition to entropy from the password. So pretty good idea. But this requires changing the token format and then supporting two token format, etc., etc. So I've been working on this for the last few weeks, and I'm going to put out a new release which will have much shorter tokens, which will be much more elegant in URLs, so this matters to me. And the trick is that instead of putting the identifier of the user, so the primary key, a hash of the email and last login date, and then hashing the whole thing with django.core.signin, which produces fairly long tokens, I'm doing a single hash. I'm putting just the primary key and doing a single hash that encodes all the rest of the functionality I need, and so the token can be shorter.
Awesome.
Yeah, so I think it's a really geeky thing to spend a bunch of hours trying just to do shorter tokens for something that makes absolutely no difference in practice. But they will look better.
I was just thinking, as you were saying, there's a saying that every developer, when they want to write a blog, they end up writing a static site generator from scratch. And I feel like every developer who has kids wants to have photos that aren't on Instagram or somewhere, because I've built a prototype of this. I think it's like the next level for a developer. You have kids and you're like, I don't want to put my pictures up on on the wide web. And then like I built a simple Django site and I was sharing logins with parents and it's too much. And I love that you played that out further, and that's the backstory for this package.
We don't judge people who have children and decide they need to build shelves in their house or something. So we shouldn't judge developers who think they need to write their own for the website.
So we're coming a little bit up on time. I have a note here to ask you about Django Debug Toolbar.
Yeah, because you wrote that, or you were maintaining it for a while, or did you? Like, what's the backstory there? Because it's one of the major pieces of infrastructure.
I think I picked it up at a time where it was in need of some maintenance. I modernized it a bit, probably deprecated some stuff that felt difficult to maintain. So I don't remember if this started because I had made changes in Django that would break the toolbar. It's possible that I started when I did the template stuff. And then the toolbar, which uses a lot of internal Django APIs, needed to be updated to account for it. Then I didn't do it for very long because it's fairly stable, and I think other people picked up the flag. So it was a temporary thing.
Yes, it's part of the jazz band thing now, the jazz band group.
You have the Python WebSockets repo. Mm-hmm. What's the backstory on all that?
The backstory is that I was working at a company where we had a project to deploy batteries, so like big batteries to power homes or cars or that sort of thing in Africa, and we'd need to monitor them, and we wanted a protocol that was fairly easy to use from, let's say, modern software. So like sending raw TCP packets or UDP packets felt a bit low level. And we thought that WebSockets would be convenient to manage centrally and could be deployed in any small Linux board that could be next to the batteries and connected to the battery management system and be used for supervision. So when I started this, actually, I was about to leave the company. So it was one of the last choices I made. And I started building WebSocket for this purpose. Also because Async.io was brand new, so it was still called Tulip at the time. And I wanted to learn it. And so WebSocket was a way to learn Async.io. Also, since the name was available on PyPy, I think it was a good time to grab it.
Basically, name squatting. I'm going to have this name. I need a library. Ah.
So that was a bit ballsy, but I still think WebSocket is a pretty good library for doing WebSocket in Python. I think it is very correct. Perhaps not always super convenient, but at least it doesn't do weird stuff. It's also very robust. For instance, at some point, the Python community discovered that you had to handle back pressure in Async.io if you didn't want your buffers to grow forever. And Nathaniel Smith, I think, wrote a post explaining all this. And it turned out that WebSockets was the only library that did this well, so included correction in the article. So that was my moment of pride with WebSocket. I got at least one thing right with Async.io. So WebSocket grew with Async.io. It has suffered a bit from the churn in APIs in Async.io as Async.io matured. And now, well, it does one thing well, gives you a basis for building servers or clients in Python. I've been working on and off since 1 year to move it to a SAN.io model. So SAN.io was very fashionable 2 or 3 years ago. I don't know if it's a long-term trend. While working on this, I have discovered that if you want to do SAN.io, so you have the core part of the protocol that implements everything except reading and writing bytes, and you do it on both ends, you end up re-implementing a lot of things inside. For instance, you need something like a stream reader. Bytes get written to this, and then you can ask for read n bytes or read until the end of line. And when you use Async.io, sure, you are coupled to the I/O, but at least Async.io gives you a stream reader for free. Then you start thinking about a writer, and so you start reasoning about how you are going to write the bytes to the network eventually. And so the more I've been working with SAN.io, the more doubts I've had about if it was a good thing. And so I have a branch that is in the middle of nowhere. So perhaps there will be a SAN.io version of WebSocket in a few years. Perhaps not. I don't know.
But it's a good learning exercise either way, no?
It is. The actual reason for doing that is that Tom Christie was working on HTTPX, and there was discussions about having WebSocket supported there. So it could have been done with WebSocket as a core SAN.io thing. Also, there is Sanic, which is depending on WebSocket, but the integration is a bit shaky because I never designed WebSocket for this, for being integrated into another server. So it would be much cleaner if I did this. So now it's really a matter of whether I find time and interest to go forward with this.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So the one thing I wanted, the other project of yours, which I like a lot, is called Django Sequences, which enables you to, from potentially multiple requests, guarantee that you're going to get an ordered sequence of identifiers, which you might use. Well, the reason I use it is for invoice generation, if you need sequential invoice numbers. But could you perhaps tell us a little bit about that?
That's why it exists. Remember I talked earlier about Autolib, the car sharing service, and then one day our accounting, which we had written in the system, gets an audit. And the auditors come back saying it's one of the best homegrown accounting that they've ever seen because the error level is, I don't know, it was 0.something%, but good enough. But we have gaps in the invoices, and this is bad. And because, well, no one told us you were not allowed to have gaps in the sequence of invoices. And we have them because of transaction rollbacks, because we discovered that when you have a transaction rollback in Postgres, it can swallow a number in the sequence of primary keys. So Django Sequences.
Yeah, okay.
Wow.
Fair enough.
But I mean, it's the sort of thing everyone learns one day. I mean, you don't know that invoice numbers have to be sequential, but someone tells you you messed up.
Yeah. So I think we're pretty much out of time. Is there anything, any other projects you're working on or work things you want to mention before we go?
Well, right now I'm trying to give some maintenance to most of my Python projects. And well, in fact, there's a good chance that I write open source in other technologies as I'm about to take a new job, which is very good, except there's no Django in there. It's Rails, Ember, and Go, all of which are good technologies, I think. But probably I'll be writing more Ruby and Go and JavaScript going forward than Python. Perhaps a bit of Python for data anyway, since it's going strong there. But we will see.
Well, I suspect you'll find your way back to Django one way or another professionally, and the lessons you've learned from those communities will cycle back. So
sure,
I'm sure that will.
I'm also looking forward to appreciating Rails more. I've wrote some Ruby on Rails very long ago, I think 12 years ago, roughly. And back then, I decided that Django was probably better. Now, with a decade of experience, I will probably have a different judgment, probably more measured. And there's certainly something that the Rails world gets right, and in the Django world we've been missing. And so I'm really looking forward seeing what I can bring across from one ecosystem to the other.
The thing I really like about Rails is a controller just gets you, like, it's like generic views, but it gets you there that much quicker. And you know, there's a little bit less. It's like you're out the gate slightly faster with Rails. That's what I really like about it. And then, you know, as you get deeper in, it's the, you know, you can do whatever in either. But I think that's something that we could try to emulate more in Django. Is that, you know, I've got a model, that's all fine. And then how do I get, you know, the form view in place really quickly? And they do things like the Ajax forms, which will, you know, nice. And then the Turbo Links is built in. And it's, you know, maybe we don't have to copy any of that, but it's, that's what I like when I'm using it. I think, yeah, this is good.
Yeah, so there are some differences in things Rails does, and we wouldn't do them in Django. It's also nice if each framework has its preferences that cater to the taste of different people. Generally, Python and Django has been much more boring, which I enjoy a lot. But again, 10 years have passed, so perhaps Rails has become boring as well. That would be really good.
Yeah, if you read Hacker News, it's definitely boring. Like Django and Rails, they're always in the, you know.
No, so people nice are rediscovering. Stuff. They're like, yeah, I thought this wasn't anything, but wow, compared to this JavaScript thing, Django's Rails are pretty good.
That sounds like Hacker News. So,
yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. I mean, from the beginning, you've been one of the people I really wanted to have on and talk to you. I've never spoken to you before, but I know, you know, your reputation is so huge in the community. So thank you for doing that. And thank you for coming on to talk about it.
Well, thank you for having me on the podcast. Talk to you soon.
Yeah, super. Thanks, Emma.
All right. Be well. Bye.